Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. You may hear us on Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. The podcasts are online at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. And a big thank you to Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar for sponsoring us. Today, my guest is Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. Mitch Roth, originally from Los Angeles, moved to Hawaii in 1983 to attend UH Manoa. And after attending Whittier Law School, he returned to Hawaii in 1993. Initially, he was a deputy prosecutor on Oahu, and then he was recruited by Hawaii County's former prosecutor to start the Community-Oriented Prosecutor Program. Obviously, his office does standard prosecuting, but also works with community agencies to try to address crime before it starts, a role different from what many folks see as the role of county prosecutor. Mitch Roth was elected county prosecutor in 2012. Mitch, thank you for being with me this morning. Aloha.
Aloha, Sherry. Thank you for having me.
Last we spoke on Island Issues, it was a year ago, and at that time you said you had 35 attorneys in Hilo, Waimea, and Kona, total staff of 112, taking in 20,000 cases a year. Where are we today?
Well, we still have about the same amount of attorneys. I think, you know, our stats are a little bit lower, but it doesn't feel like that because right now we have a lot of big cases that are coming through our office, and we still got a lot of work to do.
One of the things that you have talked about for the last many years, and certainly a year ago when we spoke, you said you were continuing the focus on cold cases. One of them you have now brought to indictment before the grand jury. In 1997, 6-year-old Peter Boy Kema disappeared. The parents had a story that they had taken Peter Boy to Oahu and given him to a woman who was never able to be found, and sadly, neither was Peter Boy. Now, you and your team have gotten the grand jury indictment accusing this 6-year-old boy's parents of murder. So, Mitch Roth, prosecutor, tell us what you can about the Peter Boy Kema case.
Well, as this case is going to trial, it's really difficult for me to talk about these cases other than to say that, you know, we want to try the cases in our courts rather than in the media. That being said, a lot of people say, well, you don't have a body, how can you prove the case? And I'll tell you, you know, with all of our cases, as prosecutors, we have an ethical duty not to bring cases unless we believe we can prove the case in court. We believe we can prove this case, and we believe that we will prove this case in court. When the facts come out, I think people will be pretty amazed at what happened. It's been brought this far because we have an amazing team of people who have been working together, not just people in my office, not just people like Billy Pereira, who's an investigator, and some of the attorneys and the victim witness people, but also because we've worked really closely with the police, and police have done an excellent job of going back out there. They put one of their detectives, Derek Morimoto, working with us as a team. We have people from other agencies that have also played a big role. And you know, I think that really is part of it. You need to work with your partners and take things little pieces at a time, go back, look at the facts. And we're looking forward for this case to come to trial. We've had a couple of cases already that are cold cases that we've got convictions on. One was Desjardins, who was a former police officer who killed his wife. Another one was Alexander Gamsky, who buried his wife in his backyard. And you know, those cases, they sat for a while. We put different people on them. We had a look with a new set of eyes, a fresh set of eyes. After doing that, we were successful. We believe that we'll be successful with the Kema cases. And we have, right now, at least two cases that are getting ready for grand jury to go forward on, also cold cases that, again, it was just a matter of looking at, thinking about different ways and re-interviewing people that, you know, first times, sometimes you don't get everything.
Mitch, something that is not actually your kuleana. In 2002, relative to the Peter Boy Kema case, the Department of Human Services released 2,000 pages of documentation that showed that they had looked into the Kema family and found there was significant child abuse going on. After they did all that investigation, they actually returned the siblings to the Kema family. And again, I know this is not your department, but can you explain why that happened? Because that seems to be the beginning of the tragedy.
Again, there's so much that I would like to say about this case. And for me to talk about that could have a prejudicial effect. I hope you understand, I want to be as careful as possible because we want to make sure we get a conviction here. And after this case is over, I'll probably have a better answer for you. But looking into it, it's a good question to ask.
Well, I do look forward to talking with you after this case is resolved. And just anecdotally, people on this island are quite pleased that your department has managed to get this particular case to where it is now. Because Peter Boy, if you say Peter Boy to almost anybody on this island, they can picture Peter Boy.
Yeah, it's taken too long to get here. And I wish that we had all the resources in the world right now, as we sit here today, this year, until the end of the year. We have 15 murder cases that are set in Hilo. And I have limited staff, and those cases take a lot of time. This case took over a year for us. You know, I wish we had more staff. I wish we had more resources, but we're doing what we can. And I'm blessed to work with some really amazing people. I swear we have the hardest working office in the county. I have people that come in on weekends. You can come late at night. There's people that are working, really working on their own because they're not getting paid overtime. People want to work because they really care about what they're doing. Justice is on the line, and they really care about that. So I'm truly blessed to work with the people that I work with.
Mitch, back to some more mundane details. People often ask, why does somebody get arrested for something and they're released without being charged? Give us a short explanation as to why that occurs so often.
There's a couple of things. We have an ethical duty not to charge cases that we don't believe we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That's one issue. The second issue is we have time limitations. There's a rule under the Hawaii Penal Code. Rule 48 says from the time you charge someone until the time they go to trial, you have 180 days. And I know you wanted to talk to me about the rape kits. We're looking at these rape kits, and a lot of times they're taking over a year to come back for DNA. 180 days is 6 months. Same thing with traffic crashes. A lot of times we have traffic crashes and we need to bring in experts to determine that the car was in working order. You know, we're waiting for blood. We're waiting for all sorts of scientific evidence that we know is not going to come back in a relatively quick time. Those cases, a lot of times, depending on what's going on with the defendant, what kind of record they have, how bad the incident is, what other evidence we have, because I've really tried to get some of those cases charged at the time versus wait for everything to come back. Depending on what we have, a lot of times we'll wait until we have all our ducks in a row versus gambling with the outcome of those cases, because we want to do the best job we can for those victims. On the other side of that, there's also justice delayed is justice denied, and so it's a balancing.
Mitch, you brought up the issue of the rape kits, and I wanted to ask you about sexual assault, which would include the rape kits. Mm-hmm. So let's start with what your office is doing about sexual assault.
Well, when I came in, I started looking at our stats, and our stats, they were not great stats.
When you say not great stats, do you mean that we have a lot of sexual assaults on this island, or that we are not getting to prosecute the sexual assaults that we have on the island?
We weren't prosecuting a lot of them, and there's various reasons. A lot of times you have victims who are young, traumatized victims. We're looking at not re-traumatizing these victims. A lot of people don't understand. They see a sex assault case against a minor or where somebody in the family, and they say, just hang that guy. Well, yeah, but you have to have a witness. And a lot of times, for whatever reason, we may not have a witness, or we may have a very fragile witness, and we have psychologists and doctors saying, you can't do that to this person. There's a debate going on around the country about waiting till the victim is ready versus if you take the victim early on, then yeah, you're going to put them through a little bit more trauma, but it's also a healing event in their life. There's a lot of debate on that. We're kind of tending right now, we've kind of changing our focus on how do we get the victim out of this trauma situation. Part of that is erring on the side of let's go forward, bring these cases in, maybe bring the victim in front of a grand jury, keep on working with them. What else can we do? One of the great things that we've done is we got a dog. Faith is really amazing. She doesn't give answers. She doesn't talk. She's a black lab, about 2 years old. She'll sit down next to a victim who is in trauma, put her head on the victim's lap, and somehow, just by doing that, allowing the victim to pet the dog, it takes some of the trauma away. A lot of people don't understand victims of sex assault, especially children. Why can't they get up there and testify? If it really happened to them, we have this whole belief that somehow the victim is at fault. That's crazy. So we're needing to change society. You know, if you take a World War II veteran, they start talking about the war. All of a sudden, their eyes start tearing over. And before you know it, they can't talk. They can't talk because that's trauma. We expect it of our greatest generation, some of the bravest men and women in our country. We expect it of them. But then there's a victim of sex assault, and, well, those crocodile tears. Why do we do that? It's trauma. And so things like having Faith, our dog there, she takes that trauma away. We have a campaign going on right now. It's called Start by Believing. Unfortunately, women sometimes are the hardest critics and hardest judges and jurors for women victims of sex assault. We need to realize that for a victim to come forward and report a sexual assault, that's really difficult. So we, as a community, we need to start by believing the victim.
Well, so Mitch, you hired a deputy specifically to handle these kinds of cases, Michelle West.
Michelle was a very experienced deputy prosecutor in California working on sex assault cases, and we figured we needed to get someone who has a different way of looking at things. Since Michelle has come in, she's been making great changes. She's reviewed over 100 sex assault cases. A lot of people are focusing on the cold case murder cases. A lot of these cases are cold case sex assault cases that are within the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations for a victim, someone who's under 18, doesn't start really running until that person turns 18. So there's a lot of older cases. Michelle's reviewed over 100 of those cases. She's assigned a bunch of those cases out. Some of those cases have been indicted, and those cases are moving through the process as well. She's looked at what the police are doing, and she's made some great recommendations. This month we have several trainings, not just on sex assault, but human trafficking, where we're training our deputies, the police, our partners, you know, the SANE nurses, the people at the YWCA, advocates, and the community to understand how to respond better to sex assault cases, and also to understand that there's an unnamed conspirator in that jury box, and that's all these ideas that we have about how people should behave themselves not to be raped, and that the victim has to prove why she was wearing those clothes and that she wasn't having sex with other people before. And, you know, it's crazy stuff. So, yeah, she's doing some amazing stuff.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. Our guest today is Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. And just as a note, we recorded this in his office in Kealakekua on Thursday. That was prior to the discovery of those three horrific murders in the Puna District. Next week, we start 2 weeks of conversation with Barry Taniguchi and Toby Taniguchi, grandson and great-grandson of the founders of KTA Superstores, who will tell us about the store's beginnings 100 years ago, about how the store grew, about the challenges of running a grocery store or any business in Hawaii, and what government can do to make businesses successful, as well as some leadership lessons. Now, let's get back to Hawaii County Prosecutor Mitch Roth. Mitch, the discussion about the rape kits, when I started reading about it in the paper, it sounded as though the police just weren't taking forensic evidence forward, because a rape kit is, in fact, forensic evidence. I asked Hawaii County Police Chief Harry Kubojiri, and he said we have around 35 untested rape kits. To me, it sounds like the issue is not lack of willingness on the part of the police to take the case forward, nor lack on the part of the prosecutor, but where we get the rape kits tested is all through the Honolulu Investigative Services, and that they have a huge backload, and that's why we're not getting it done.
Right. You know, we've had a couple of cases where the suspect admitted that they've had sex with the victim. We used to look at those cases and say, okay, we really need to have this kit tested because we know who did it. We've changed that, and we're saying, yeah, we want all of these rape kits tested, because what we found is that just because someone is involved in this rape here doesn't mean that they're not involved with another rape someplace else. We're seeing across the country a lot of times you test these kits and you're finding other cases where this person is a suspect. So we've asked all kits to be tested. That being said, the process that we go through is a rape kit is done. The chief of police, Harry Kubojiri, writes a letter to the chief of police in Honolulu. They say that we have this rape kit that we want tested. They wait until they can test it, and sometimes that takes about a year. They say, yes, okay, we're ready for your kit, send it over. So we send the kit over, then they do the testing, and then we get the results back. Interesting thing on this, all of the police departments and all of the prosecutor's office just put in for a grant to see if we can get funds so we can send them other places to speed that up. So we're looking at solutions on how do we get it done quicker. The problem is I don't think we have the resources in Hawaii to do them expeditiously.
Is the Honolulu Police Department the only place to get it done? And does it cost us that much more to send it out of the state?
Yes.
Okay.
quite frankly. On the national grants, we're seeing figures like $400. When we were asking, we're seeing figures of like $6,000 to $8,000. Now, you have to remember that when we send DNA off to a lab on the mainland, we're going to have to also pay for that person to come back and testify. We may have to pay for a couple of those people to come back and testify, which means not only airfare and per diem, but you don't just bring them back for a half an hour, you're bringing them back for a couple of days. So you have to put them up in a hotel, get a car, pay for food, and all those things. So it can be kind of costly.
Let's turn to juvenile cases. You talked to the Hawaii County Council in their budget hearing at the beginning of April, and you talked about a reduction in juvenile cases. Talk about what you're talking about.
One of the things that I said when I ran, we're going to think smarter, not just tougher. How do you do that? Well, one of the things is you start to look at where you have your biggest problems. One of the biggest problems that we saw is in recidivism, and more specifically, recidivism of juvenile offenders. Our Hawaii Youth Correctional Facility, or our kids' jail in Honolulu, they have a recidivism rate of about 75%. We pay about $190,000 per juvenile per year. And if you think about grades, if 75% is recidivism, that means you have a success rate of about 25%. That's not a great rate. We also looked at what was happening with kids on probation. We still saw a lot of problems. One of the things that happens, and you have to understand what happens when a police officer arrests a kid in Hawaii County and pretty much the rest of the state. A kid gets arrested. We have a very short time frame to make the case. Adults, we have 48 hours. Juveniles, we may have 6 hours. You don't want to keep a juvenile locked up. So they'll release the juvenile back to the parents. The police will go on with their investigation. They will then send the case up, unless it's a really serious case. They'll send the case to probation. Probation has a file, a stack of files on their desk, and they'll review the cases. They'll make a decision that this case needs to come to the prosecutors. They'll send it to the prosecutors, and our prosecutors are pretty busy, so they have a stack of cases on their desk, plus they're in court, and plus they're doing other things. One of the reasons why a lot of them are working till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night to stay up to speed with everything. By the time the cases were getting into court, when I first started as a prosecutor, it was taking us almost a year to just get to the starting line. And then somewhere after a year for the case to be resolved. Now think about that for a second. You're a juvenile, you commit a crime, and it may be a year and a half later before you're getting your punishment. Kids, I don't want to say they're like puppies, but you know, they kind of forget what happened a year and a half ago. We're doing a lot of things. We're working with different organizations, Boys to Men, Hoku Pa'a, another youth group that's working on how you make kids successful. We worked on a program called Hawaii Island Honors, where we honored some teachers for the great work they're doing. We were working with Youth Challenge. But one of the great things that came through the prosecutor's office is something called BIJAC. BIJAC is the Big Island Juvenile Intake and Assessment Center. What happens is police will arrest the juvenile. They'll bring them to BIJAC. BIJAC does an assessment.
Where is that?
BIJAC is run through the Salvation Army in Hilo, and we're desperately trying to get one on the West Hawaii side. So they do the assessment, and they find out, well, maybe this kid needs family counseling. Maybe the family needs family counseling. Maybe they need drug treatment. You know, whatever they need, they're trying to get them into the services up front. They do the services by the time they get into court. If they've done everything, we look at that's part of the sentence and you can move on and get going with these kids. What we're finding at BIJAC is our recidivism rates are about 5 to 6%. So that means there's a 94% success rate for what we're seeing. Kids aren't coming back again and again and again and again. You're moving all of the punishment and everything up to the front. If you don't get punished for a year and a half later, nothing happens. But if you start having consequences up in the front and you start getting the services up in the front and getting kids back on track and getting families back on track up in front, you can make big differences. And so this was a program actually started by Jay through Charlene. Luckily, again, I get to write on their coattails. It didn't open up until 2013.
And just to be clear, Jay is Jay Kimura, the previous prosecuting attorney, and Charlene Eboshi was his successor after he left.
So we've worked on different things. One of the exciting things that we're working on right now is something called Camp Agape. I don't know, have you heard of Camp Agape?
I have not.
I'm really excited about Camp Agape. Camp Agape is a camp that is put on for children of incarcerated parents. And it's put on mainly through New Hope Church, and some of the other churches are getting involved now. It's a four-day camp. 4 days, they have a different topic every day that they're working on. The first day is trust. A lot of these kids have trust issues. Second day is love. Third day is forgiveness, because there's a lot of forgiveness that needs to be going on. And the fourth day is hope. In addition to the topics, they do the camp stuff. They go horseback riding, they go surfing, they go climbing. They do fun stuff that kids need to do. Well, you'd be asking, why would the prosecutor be looking into kids of incarcerated parents? Well, we know that these kids have a strong likelihood of entering into the criminal justice system. Something like 50% of them will enter into the criminal justice system. That is pretty scary. And if you don't start working on the kids before they get into these problems, you're going to be working on it both in juvenile court and as adults. And how I got involved to come and talk. I went and I was kind of like, what am I going to talk to these kids about? These kids are going to hate me. I'm putting their parents in jail. Luckily for me, the day I went, the topic was forgiveness. And they had this luau, and I had no clue what I was going to talk about. But before I got up and talked, these kids started telling their stories of the mother who was choosing an abusive, maybe even molesting boyfriend over the child. Parents who were choosing drugs over them, who would spend their money buying drugs versus getting food for the kids to eat. I mean, it was chicken skin kind of moment. And for me, I kind of, like that, I got it. They don't really hate me. What we're doing as prosecutors and police and law enforcement is we're helping protect these kids by taking that negative element out. So about 3 years I've been working with this program, getting involved, trying to raise funds for them, going and volunteering. I actually got a chance to go to Oahu where they have their big Camp Agape, 200 kids. This year we'll have about 100 kids on this island. But while I was on Oahu, I was volunteering in the water, helping these kids who are surfing. I was volunteering with a couple of guys. One of the guys next to me was a convicted felon. So that was kind of interesting, having, you know, some conversations with this convicted felon who's now out trying to make his life a better life. Next to me on another side was a Supreme Court Justice, Mike Wilson, and then Judge Mike Towne. And it was just this bizarre feeling being in the water with two judges and a convict. It's like, wow, this is something really, really different. What I saw at the camps is these kids come in a lot of times with an attitude. They leave with just amazing feeling. You know, a lot of the volunteers, what they say is that, you know, they're there to give the kids a lot of love. They didn't put themselves in that situation. That's a parent that did something wrong, and really quite amazing and quite gratifying. A lot of people think about prosecutors, all we do is prosecute cases. My view is our job is to make this community a safer and healthier place. And part of that is you don't just respond and react. You got to be proactive. I think that the numbers coming down, there's a lot of different explanations. That, you know, I heard the mayor talk about the parks and stuff like that. I think it's a lot of people doing a lot of things. We're just part of it. But it's great to be a part of some of the great things that are happening on this big island as we look at juvenile justice and the way we're handling things, what probation department is doing and how they're looking at cases, how we're working together with probation and even defense attorneys on juvenile cases. I think it's making a huge difference.
Well, anytime you can get kids while they're young and help change their mindset, and I look at these kids in Camp Agape, they've been raised in a family where crime is the life, and you're trying to show them that crime does not have to be the life. Mitch, you talked about this convicted felon you were working next to in the water, and that leads me to overcrowding in jails. There's been discussion of trying to release nonviolent prisoners, and I know you talked when you were running for office about the overcrowding in the jails problem. Talk about what you know about the potential on Hawaii Island of releasing nonviolent offenders, how it might work, and whether that's a solution.
You'll find this interesting. I actually think that it's the tail wagging the dog. What is a nonviolent offender? we're talking about people that burglarize people's houses. You talk to a victim of burglary, and they're going to tell you, I felt like I was raped. There's a visceral feeling. What about the drug guys? Well, a lot of these drug guys have a $200, $300 a day habit. Now, you can earn your money a couple of different ways. You can earn it by working really hard. A lot of these people don't have jobs because they have a drug habit. You can earn it by selling your property. That runs out pretty quickly. You can sell yourself, prostitution, or you can earn it by ripping off or doing other things. So to say, well, let's just let out the nonviolent offenders, it really doesn't make sense. What I think we need to do is we need to look a little bit more seriously and do assessments about who we're putting in. And then on the back end, we have to think about these people coming out. Are we just going to say, okay, you're out. Leave them nothing where they get out and they can't get a job. They may have good intentions. They have no mentorship. They have nothing out there. Pretty soon, what are they going to be doing? Well, what we know that they end up doing is they start using drugs. They start getting back into the life of crime. You really need to think a little bit harder about the issues. And so there's a lot of easy solutions. The easy solution is just let the nonviolent offenders out. The tougher solutions are, what are we doing with the people that are coming out? What are we doing with the people that are not quite there? And what are we doing with the people that are going in? Which is something that as prosecutors, we generally don't think about.
But you do.
Well, yeah. My focus is, how do we keep our island safer and healthier? Part of that is being proactive, working with the communities. Part of that is working with the kids. And part of that is looking at restorative justice. What does that mean? This last year, we were able to obtain a grant to hire someone to work on restorative justice programs. And that person is Tim Hansen. He's been in our office as a volunteer coordinator for the last couple of years, working on things like Pacific Islander Youth Career Days for kids. Tim, before he came to our office, he came from Minnesota, where he started this great restorative justice program. Restorative justice is a comprehensive restorative response to harm that honors victims, holds offenders accountable, and strengthens the communities, leaving communities stronger after a crime happens.
And that means in English, what exactly?
Well, it means a whole bunch of things. You want to try to bring everybody to the same level. To your victims, you want to bring them back to where they were before the crime happened. You want to bring your community back up to where it was before the crime happened. And you also want to work with the offender to make him or her a productive member of the community. So we have a couple of things that are going on. One of the things is community or victim offender conferencing. We're providing victims and offenders a chance to meet a lot of times before a sentence has been doled out, to kind of come up with some solutions.
So meaning if somebody burglarizes my house, we would actually meet?
Not necessarily in a burglary. I take burglaries pretty seriously. But maybe some of the lower level crimes, the misdemeanors, petty misdemeanors, you know, someone tags your house or shoplifting or something like that, or especially kids, they get into an argument, they make threats. Sometimes we want to do some mediation between neighbors. We were also started this program where after someone has been convicted, setting up upon the desire of the victim. If the victim doesn't want to do that, then that's a non-starter. You may have a victim or a victim's family that may want to have a chance to talk to the offender. For the victims, a lot of times people want to know, why did you do that? There's questions that are going on in their mind, and sometimes having the offender realize what the victims go through is very powerful. One of the things that we're doing, and we're just getting done with our first class, is we're doing this victim impact classes at Hawaii Community Correctional Facility, HCCC. We have a class of male offenders and we have a class of female offenders. One of our victim witness counselors and one of our interns have been going and holding classes inside of the jail with people who have been convicted, and we've been bringing victims in, not necessarily the victims of their crimes. We'll have the victims come in, they'll talk, and then the offenders and our counselors, they kind of process. And some of the things that I'm hearing back are that these guys who are incarcerated, being faced with victims of crime, telling their story, and then having to go through this process, we're hearing stories of offenders crying because they didn't realize the pain that they caused. And a lot of times, they were in there because of a drug habit. where they're masking their own pain. And so it's bringing things up. For the last class, I get to go and talk to these guys to make them understand about the victims that they don't realize. They're kids. They're kids who stand a huge chance of coming into the criminal justice system. We're the last state in the country to have victim services going to our prisons. These classes, by the way, what they've shown in Delaware, I believe, they went from a 67% recidivism rate to a 35% recidivism rate. If we can lower our recidivism rate by half, that means half as many people are going to be burglarized, half as many drug addicts. That makes our community safer and healthier. And that's really what I believe that our call to action is. It's not just to react. We have to make our community safer and healthier.
Mitch, you have always been attempting to stop the number of drunk driving and impaired driving accidents we have on Hawaii Island. And I saw some statistics from the state judiciary that appears as though Hawaii Island has less. Give us your perspective on this, because it sounds like things are going well, but I need you to help us understand.
Yeah, you know, I'm really pleased to see when you look at the statistics from 2011, 2012 to 2014, 2015, these are the judiciary statistics. They're saying that our numbers of our DUI cases, DWI, OVUII, operating a vehicle under the influence of alcohol or drugs, they're saying that our numbers are down by about 30%. Now, you can say, well, the police just aren't arresting people. Well, that could be true, but I also sit on the State Strategic Highway Safety Committee, and we're looking at three-year averages for fatalities. Hawaii County is blowing away the rest of the state. Fatalities on our roadways are down by half. That's pretty amazing. Part of it's the police, part of it's the community education that's going out in the community. And I think one of the bigger things that we have is the ALEA law, which allows police to tow vehicles of people who are intoxicated, people who are driving without a license, people who have fake licenses. The tows, I think, have also greatly reduced the number of drunk driving incidences and fatalities on our islands. So, yeah, I think we're doing good, but we're not doing great because one death is one too many. You know, last year we had about 18 to 20. The year before, I think we were around 13. This year, we're kind of moving up a little bit, but not to where we were maybe 5 or 6 years ago. We need to use education, enforcement, engineering. Everything is going our way right now.
And I'd like to remind people that ALEA's law is named after ALEA Braden, who is the little girl. I think she was around 2, and there was a crash at the intersection of Lako Street and Kuakini Highway, and a drunk driver just crashed right into her mom's car, and little ALEA Braden died. And so this law was named after her to make it easier for the police to stop the driver from actually driving off, right?
That is correct.
Are we still using breathalyzers, meaning if somebody gets arrested for a DUI, they may have to use a breathalyzer on their car?
The ignition interlock, yes. We still have ignition interlocks, and I just saw a figure that last year there was over, I think, 12,000 prevented starts where people had alcohol in their breath. People that we've convicted or have gone through the administrative driver's license revocation process where they've tried to start their cars, and that's a statewide number, 12,000.
One more thing. I have seen documented reports of squatters moving into homes on Hawaii Island where the homes are either in foreclosure or sometimes the people just are not here on this island or sometimes the owner's actually dead. It appears from the people who are documenting all this that they feel like not enough is being done. Talk about what you know about squatters moving into homes and what the police or prosecutor are doing or what the role should be.
So yeah, definitely illegal. We have actually prosecuted some people. The problem that we're having is the owners of the homes, a lot of times they're foreclosed homes, and we have a hard time getting in touch with the banks or their attorneys just to tell the police, no, they can't be there. We actually recommended and didn't go anywhere this year, but we're recommending some laws where if you're going to foreclose, already the law is if you're renting a place, you have to have an on-island manager. But we're trying to figure out a way of having somebody that's recognizable that the police can go to. And foreclosure actions, the obvious person would be the attorneys that they're using. But if we don't have an owner or a legitimate person to say that, it's hard for the police to move anywhere and it doesn't come to our office. The cases that we've seen is there's an actual owner, the owner says something. When that happens, then we try to bring those cases as quickly as we can.
Mitch Roth, anything else you'd like to add before we say aloha?
No, I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity to come. And we live on an amazing island with amazing people. And I just feel so blessed and fortunate to live here.
Thank you, Mitch Roth. Aloha.
Thank you. Aloha.
And thank you so much to our listeners. This is Island Issues, sponsored by Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar at Queen's Shops and on Ali'i Drive. I'm Sherry Bracken. I'll see you next Sunday for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahoi ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.